So I'm here to talk to you a little bit about what we found from looking at H1N1 vaccination rates in New York City. I just want to quickly acknowledge my co-author on this project who couldn't be here today, Ari Weisfuss. So this is a very, very preliminary analysis of the data. We actually just got the data in, I think, June or July after 8 months of begging the Bureau of Immunizations for it. So we have a lot more to do, but I just want to show you what we've started with. I have nothing to disclose. Okay, I just wanted to give you a little bit of background about the H1N1 situation in New York City, if you didn't follow the news. So we had the virus emerge in New York City at the same time that they confirmed that there was this novel influenza virus circulating in Mexico. So that just sort of speaks to these new pandemics that we're seeing in the globalization of disease. We had about 1,000 hospitalizations just in the city, and 50 people died as a result of complications from H1N1. As with most pandemics, this one occurred in a couple of waves, first in the spring and then in the fall. And of course, it wasn't until that fall wave that we actually had the vaccinations. And then finally, I just wanted to put this out there because we're very proud of this statistic. Once we did get that vaccine, we were able to vaccinate over 250,000 people in the New York City area. All right, so there were several ways that we went about dispensing the vaccination once we had it in hand. I'm just going to talk about one specifically. This is our point of dispensing or point of distribution plan. There were other ways of dispensing the vaccine that people accessed. That was through private providers, through pharmacies, and other methods, but I'm going to focus on the points of dispensing. So a little background on points of dispensing. So this is a plan for a citywide event. If we were to have a public health incident that required mass prophylaxis of the whole city, we'd use what we call our points of dispensing plan to give out those vaccines or antibiotics to the public. And this is based on the national planning scenario of a citywide anthrax attack. This is something the federal government requires jurisdictions to plan for, and in New York City what that translates to is we have to have a plan to vaccinate 8.5 million people in 48 hours. So during the fall of 2009, we had the good fortune, I guess you could say, of being able to practice a part of this system. You know, we've never tried to turn on the whole system at once, but we have been trying to do it a little bit piecemeal just to get a sense of what it would be like. So in 2009, we used the pods to distribute the H1N1 vaccine. We ended up opening 29 pods over the course of 5 weekends. There was one in each of the 5 city boroughs, as well as a couple extra ones in Queens and Brooklyn at the beginning of the outbreak so that we could cover the higher density populations there. All in all, just through the pod system itself, we were able to distribute over 37,000 or so vaccines to the public. So for the analysis, there was a few places that we were able to get data from to help us in our mapping. The first was the actual vaccination data that came from the screening forms that the public had to turn in when they came to the clinics to get the vaccine. So the data we extracted from those forms were the addresses, so where people lived that were coming to get the vaccine. Also the date of vaccination. We haven't done so much analysis on over the course of the weeks who did and did not access the vaccine, but we at least have that information in hand. And then finally, the location of the pod sites. So we use this data to create maps demonstrating geographic patterns of vaccination in the city for H1N1. And then we analyze these patterns in relation to what we call conditions of interest for H1N1. So these were the conditions associated with more severe outcomes from H1N1 infection. And those included asthma, diabetes, HIV, pregnancy, and obesity. And then to look at these conditions of interest, we drew data from a couple of sources. One was the New York City Community Health Survey, which is an annual survey that the city does to assess health behaviors and health outcomes in the city, as well as data from specific agency programs, in particular HIV and diabetes, who have very up-to-date records on condition rates in the various neighborhoods. So there were 3 basic stages to our analysis, and I'll go into each one in detail in a little bit, but just to give you an overall sense, the first thing we did was to calculate what we call risk scores for each neighborhood. So these are based on the conditions of interest, you know, how we would consider that population at risk as compared to another neighborhood in terms of, you know, how many people have a certain condition. Secondly, we calculated what we call usage scores. So this is just based on the number of clients that showed up at the pause to get the vaccine in each neighborhood. And then we mapped those two data layers and compared the layers to see what the intersections were. So some detail on the risk score calculation. We took those the data on rates of conditions of interest from that community health survey and the DOHMH programs. We weighted those values by the rates at which those people or those populations were being hospitalized for H1N1. And then we mapped that out. And then in addition, we gave each neighborhood what we called a cumulative risk score. So in any given neighborhood, you know, we had these five conditions of interest, so we assessed that neighborhood based on those five conditions, and then we added those scores together to get what we called a cumulative risk score for each city neighborhood. As far as the usage score calculation, we took the pod client address data. We did a very simple, well, I call it simple, it took forever because there's so many records, but we geocoded those addresses and then mapped them in ArcMap. And for any of you who use GIS regularly and are more familiar with the technical side of things, we used the HOTS analysis tool to do a point and polygon analysis for each of the neighborhoods. So then we gave the neighborhoods a usage score, and that usage score is representing the proportion of pod clients in relation to the total neighborhood population. And before I go on to the next slide, I just want to say Roy totally stole my thunder talking about the breakdown and what kind of data layers you use depending on what you're looking at. But we use neighborhood data based on what we call the United Hospital Fund neighborhoods. This is how the health department assesses neighborhood by neighborhood health conditions or interests for the public health department. So this is all neighborhood-based data, and Roy, I apologize if these neighborhoods don't exactly match what your expectations are for Harlem and the like. But that's what we got. All right, so the results. So, this is not showing up well, but what you're supposed to be looking at is a basic map of the city. These are just the AIDS rates for the various neighborhoods, HIV, AIDS, people living with it. So what we're looking for, what we're trying to look for here is concentrating on those darker shaded areas. So those are areas in which there are more people living with HIV AIDS and therefore are at greater risk for complications from H1N1. I don't know why my circles are not showing up, but there are green circles on this map for each neighborhood, and those circles represent that usage score, so how many pod clients in proportion to the total neighborhood population actually got the vaccine. So if you could see it, what we were looking for here is we're looking for neighborhoods with dark shading and small circles. Those are our foci of interest. This is what diabetes looks like. Again, it's not very useful if you can't see the circles. Asthma rates. So the pod client rates don't change between maps. It's always going to be the same size circles, so to speak. But you'll see the shading of the neighborhoods changes depending on the condition of interest. And that's why we wanted to give each neighborhood a cumulative risk score, because we want to be able to incorporate all of the different conditions of interest. Obesity rates in the city. Pregnancy. This is interesting. So we don't actually have pregnancy rates. We used as a proxy live births in the city, which we do have from our vital records department. And then finally, we come to our cumulative risk map. So this is the map that shows you when you take all of those conditions of interest together and take those scores and add them up for the neighborhoods, these are the neighborhoods that were most, what we considered most at risk for hardships due to H1N1. And no surprise, I'm not going to show you these data layers, but traditionally these are areas of lower socioeconomic status, less access to healthcare, and things of that nature. All right, so again, can't see the circles, but I would like to highlight, just because I know, up in the upper area of the map there, you have some of those darker shaded areas. Those also were less represented in that pod client data. Some of these darker areas of Brooklyn and Queens in the middle, also underrepresented at the pods, as well as Far Rockaways and Queens down at the bottom. All right, so from just doing this very preliminary analysis, what we found is that neighborhoods which we thought were going to be, you know, at very high assumed risk for difficulties from H1N1 did not utilize this pod system. And keep in mind, this was a free vaccination. Anyone could show up and get the vaccine. And so, you know, we felt hopefully we were getting the messages out. If you're pregnant, if you have asthma, if you have diabetes, please come get the vaccine. And what we found was in certain neighborhoods, those people did not come get the vaccine. And then in other areas, which were at lower risk for complications from H1N1, we actually found high rates of representation in the pod data. So what we're hoping to do with this type of analysis is to, as we identify those areas of high risk and low pod utilization, that we might be able to target some of our outreach areas to those neighborhoods around vaccination in the future. Now, one caveat here, one of the limitations to this study is that when you're looking at something like vaccination and all you have is whether the person came or did not come, you know, particularly in this situation where we're just looking at the pods, they could have gotten it other places, right? So they could have gotten it from the doctor or, you know, the community health clinic or wherever. So it's, you know, we're not necessarily seeing that these people didn't get vaccinated. They just didn't get vaccinated through pods. So one way we thought we might sort of mitigate that impact on the data was to look at seasonal influenza vaccination rates to see if that matched up with the rates of vaccination from H1N1. So we mapped out the seasonal influenza vaccination rates, and what you're looking for here is the lighter areas, which indicate lower rates of seasonal influenza vaccination, which we then you know, made the assumption that historically, if you didn't really get your vaccination in the past, you might not get it in the future. So then just looking very quickly back to the cumulative risk, we're looking at the dark areas here. So then our final map is we're looking at the seasonal influenza vaccination rates, concentrating on the light areas. And when you do the map overlay with the cumulative risk, identifying areas with high cumulative risk, low seasonal influenza vaccination rates, and low representation in the pod data. And those neighborhoods are the red stars. So hopefully we can use this information to say, okay, well, here's the geography of how things panned out with H1N1. So maybe we could use some of our limited resources to go do more outreach in these areas. All right, just a few limitations again to the study. As I mentioned, there are other ways that people could have gotten the vaccine. Through their healthcare providers and the like. We didn't collect risk factor data at the pods, so while we'd like to assume that everyone that got the vaccine had some condition of interest, we can't say that for certain because we didn't ask people if they had asthma or that sort of thing. Of course, anytime you're doing mapping, you know, your maps are only as good as your data, and we're using 2000 census data to look at our population. So hopefully we'll be able to do this again when they release the 2010 data. We have missing and incomplete immunization records. You know, we had 37,000 good records, so I think that's a pretty good data set. But the scientists will always argue, well, it's not complete, so, you know, can we really make any conclusions from this? And then finally, we can't really draw conclusions as to why people didn't get the vaccination. So we know that they came or didn't come, but we don't know why. But I would like to think that this type of analysis at least serves as a preliminary look at where to go, you know, from what we have. So we know the where, we don't know the why, but at least we can go to the where to find out the why. All right, and finally, I just wanted to conclude by acknowledging a couple of people. Dr. Isaac Weisfuss, who is our Deputy Commissioner for the Division of Disease Control. He now heads the Office of Emergency Preparedness and Response. And also Dr. Jane Zucker, who is our Director of the Bureau of Immunizations, who was so kind in letting me manipulate her data. So thank you very much.
Let me just in passing say that New York City Department of Health gets it right because their data conform to the city planning community districts. So there's a coherent geography and the health data is tracked within the coherent geography at, you know, DOH. That's a high standard.
So thanks to all of our panelists for letting us know about their efforts throughout the U.S. and affiliated territories to map communities and share with us the lessons that they learned. I think that they'd be happy to answer questions from the audience at this point. If you have a question, just raise your hand and I'll call on people. And please do stand up and let us know your name and where you're from and which panelist you're directing your questions to. Just as a reminder, we have Roy who told us about the Gulf region, Jeanette who talked about the Pacific Islands, Eric about Colorado, and Morgan about New York. So questions? This includes the panelists, if you have questions for each other.
Sure. Actually, having caught just the tail end of Morgan's presentation, did you relate these various risk factors by community and look at the confluence of risk factors for any reason other than risk of H1N1?
Let me just
repeat the question.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So he was just asking, did they look at risk factors other than H1N1 and disease outcomes?
Right, so so far we haven't looked at some of those other factors. We know that there are other factors into play there as far as socioeconomic status and things of that nature. The goal of this type of analysis is to be able to do it during the incident. So, particularly for the New York City Department of Health, the commissioner's main concern is who might get the disease based on health risk factors. So that's why we did the analysis using those. But yes, those, other factors certainly come into play.
That could be very powerful.
Absolutely. And as we continue to work on this analysis, we'll certainly include those layers.
Other things people'd like to know, yeah? So the question was, were there actual geographic maps for the assets matching mapping project?
We did not produce actual maps because the place that we're dealing with is so small. Everybody was pretty clear about where things were, but we certainly have looked at that as we move forward with this food mapping project, that the plan in Panape is to create a map with all of the restaurants and the food stands and things like that. But specifically for this, we didn't do it because everybody knew where it was and it was so small. So, but certainly for other areas, if you had more room, it would be very useful.
Yeah.
So the question was for Morgan if she had GIS experience prior to this project.
I did. I started out, my initial experience with GIS was doing hurricane response in North Carolina. So we started in 2003 doing health assessments following Hurricane Isabel. And at the time we were just using paper maps to try to draw a sample and locate homes and inquire about people's needs at the time. That developed into a handheld computer-based data collection system utilizing GPS and GIS mapping to draw more scientific samples, for one thing, so we're not flipping coins to decide what the next house is, and also so we could start using the visualizations and maps to show the decision makers, look, here's where you need to put the resources. So I did that starting in 2003. From there, I worked with the North Carolina Center for Public Health Preparedness, doing more of these types of community health assessments using the GIS and GPS infrastructure that they had in place there. So this presentation, this work, is actually has nothing to do with my official job at the health department. It's just something that I've been very interested in because I do enjoy GIS and I understand the power of being able to use maps
to demonstrate to particularly decision makers, look here where the problems are, you can see it on these people. So that was sort of my general trajectory. I never took, I've taken a few online courses. I won't mention any particular ones for fear of retribution, but I was mostly self-taught. I just surrounded myself with people who knew the technology really well, and they were able to, you know, show me the ropes, and because of a natural interest I have in it, I just continued to utilize it until I got more familiar with it.
Yes?
So the question was, has anyone used Google Maps as a source of information?
Yeah, I've used that. We're actually doing a project right now where we're trying to analyze access to these pods, you know, physical access. So we're using Google Maps to do things like, you know, we know a highway runs through somewhere because there's a data layer that shows that from city planning, but we don't know until we really look into like Google Maps, or we use Google Earth a lot actually, to see, you know, is there an overpass that they could cross this highway at, or is there an underpass, or you know, this area that it seems like, you know, nobody was there, is that now an industrial zone that we weren't aware of, you know? So we do use it a lot actually to sort of refine the maps that we already have in place.
Can I add something? I'm with
So that discussion was just about mashups with Google Maps and GIS, right, is that what you said? And I think exporting the KML files from Google Maps and importing them to ArcMap. So the question was just, have any of the panelists stored their maps online with security or for public access?
In a different project that I'm working with, we do have maps that are stored online, and they're such a restricted little corner of the internet that they're not reachable by a Google search. They're, you know, what is it, an HTTPS, so they're like within a site that you need to have a particular access code to get to. So yes, you can store them. Yes, you can store them securely.
In Colorado, we put all of our maps in this report, and then they're available all online too, based on the website or the PDF. They're all PDF'd on the website. If you Google Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment Obesity Report, you'll be able to get this as a PDF.
And in New York City, on the health department's website, you can get a lot of that community health survey data in map form. So you can see, you know, what neighborhoods compare with what other neighborhoods in terms of all the questions they ask on that community health survey, which is pretty extensive. This particular project would never be public. I think that based on the political situation of the health department, you know, this is just for our own use and to just help us improve our work.
Other questions? Further comments from you guys? Okay, well, I'd like to thank our gracious panelists and also our gracious audience. I think we had a really productive and interesting session. So thanks, and enjoy the rest of the conference.